is the New South Wales Country Hour with Michael Condon on ABC Radio New South Wales.
Hello again and welcome to the show. Coming up, wine grape growers in the Murrumbidgee irrigation area feeling the pinch with prices of both red and white varieties down another $25 to $50 a tonne in the latest pricing. And keep calm and stay still. That's the 10-year-old farm girl's advice to surviving a deadly snake bite.
When I got bitten by a snake, I ran up to the school room and Mum wasn't even out the door by the time I got there. And she took me inside and saw the snake bite, so she put a belt just under my knee and then wrapped it with bandages. Dad was down at the yards just about to get him off a cattle in. So he come up and drove us to the hospital, and then I got flown out by a helicopter, which was fun.
Yeah, lots of fun flying out in a helicopter. You can always send us a text here at the country. 0467 922 684 is the number to text me here at the Country Hour. But first up to wine, and wine grape growers in the Murrumbidgee irrigation area, they're feeling the pinch again. Prices for red and white varieties down another $25 to $50 a tonne. For many growers, that means they're earning well below what the cost of production is for the fruit, and it's all landing at the same time as they're being slammed with high irrigation water prices and a slump in wine demand. Riverina Wine Grape Growers CEO Jeremy Cass told Kara Jeffrey the region has already lost 5,000 hectares of vineyards since 2022, and more growers will walk away if the prices don't improve.
Prices have been released by the signatories to the voluntary code of conduct. So there's three prices being released from three of our major wineries so far. Unfortunately, they're showing signs of the times by, you know, the prices have actually retracted even further than what they were last year, which is a horrible perspective for the farmers out there who have to, especially if you have to buy water this year to manage your investment. So both reds and whites have reduced in price this year, and whites were one of the things that were helping keep people sort of a little bit buoyant out there, even though they weren't anywhere near where they should be in a normal market situation. So it's very disheartening. And, you know, when you sort of start to see it, the prices that we've seen so far, although I've only gone over one or two of the price lists at this stage, seem to be reduced by between $25 to $50 a tonne right across the board.
And how significant is that fall, especially given growers were already below the cost of production in some cases?
It's extremely significant. You know, I was talking to our chairman earlier today. His phone's been running hot today, as has mine. We've had growers coming into the office and asking what we can do, and there's really nothing we can do. You know, like, the government seems to abandon us on all fronts, and, you know, it was very disappointing to see Anthony Albanese on TV the other day suggesting that the wine industry's fixed and better than ever, because it's far from that. In fact, it's the worst we've ever seen, and I've been saying that for the last 3 years, and every year seems to blindside me by managing to get that little bit worse.
How are growers reacting to another price drop? Are they at the point where some will pull out vines or switch to an alternative crop? What's the feedback there that you're hearing?
What we're seeing at the moment is, over the past three to four years, we saw people get out of the industry early. And, you know, to give you an example, our acreage or our hectareage of vineyard in the area is reduced from about 22,000 hectares when I first started the job at the beginning of 22 to less than 17,000 hectares today. So we've lost 5,000 hectares in that period. And at first, we lost about 1,500 hectares to people changing into other crops. But everyone else seems to have wanted to try and hang on. And now we're just seeing guys that just can hang on no longer. And it's not so much a case of removing vines. It's, you know, most of those reserves are gone, so they haven't got the choice to move into anything else or to remove those vines. So, you know, in a lot of cases, we'll see those vines being abandoned, which will cause localised biosecurity issues and is really community destroying, because, you know, you could have been a neighbour, friendly neighbour with someone for the last 30 or 40 years, both growing grapes, and all of a sudden one of you can't go on anymore and the other bloke's trying to manage his crop, and if disease pressures escalate, then, you know, a lot of those spores will blow across the fence, and that will cause problems on a community level with, you know, growers who have been friends for that amount of time, you know, suddenly being at loggerheads. It's a really, really hard thing, and I think going forward, water is going to be the thing that plays the most impact on this. But I really worry that we were looking at an overcorrection in our industry that we won't be able to come back from, because, you know, we've done our sums, and even at $500 a ton, to if you grew a 20 ton to the hectare crop for the next 20 years and you had no market failure, it would take you 18 years to recoup your investment to reap land again. So you can put the money in the bank for 20 years, and you're going to be $17,000 better off at the end of it without risking your upfront capital, which basically your vineyards at the moment are worth more without the vineyard on them than when they are with the vineyard on them. So they're basically unsaleable with vines.
And you mentioned earlier in the interview that you feel that the Prime Minister has a complete misunderstanding of what's happening for wine grape growers. So I guess what's your message to him of what is happening on the ground and what he could do for your growers in your region?
Australian Grape and Wine for the last 2 years has put in a pre-budget submission for $85 million, $30 million of which was aimed at grape growers to be able to transfer into other crops, which is something we desperately need, because at the end of the day, we believe that, you know, this has all impacted on us far more quickly than the rest of the world due to Scott Morrison challenging China on COVID and those tariffs that came in. So we haven't really had time to adjust, and that's just put us in a world of hurt with the oversupply that continues to be a burden. And, you know, you look at last year's crop and then you see what's come out of Wine Australia, and they're telling us that, you know, there's more there in the oversupply market now than there was at the end of last vintage. So the situation is getting worse, and I think that's why we're seeing that reflected in the prices as wineries compete with one another to get sales, which is really a race to the bottom.
Riverina Wine Grape Growers CEO Jeremy Cass speaking there to Cara Jeffrey. You're listening to The Country Hour, 12 minutes past 12. Well, with a few storms around the central west overnight, there's been a bit of a concern about how the cherries have been faring, and we all want to make sure that we're going to be ready for Christmas to put them on the Christmas table in just under 2 weeks' time. Our reporter Emily Middleton caught up with Fiona Hall, who's owner of multiple vineyards under Bite Riot across the central west, to ask how her cherries are going.
Oh, yesterday we had about 20 mil here in Orange. It came down pretty ferocious, but what happened is that we had wind after it, and then we got the helicopters out, and then it's remained cool. So they're all the saving graces after a dump of rain. So we're not seeing much damage at all. We are about to hit the peak here in Orange. We've been going for about a month in Mudgee, and up to date it's been absolutely fantastic growing weather, with the cherries really getting a lot of sweetness with the cool nights and not too hot a days. So we've had a perfect growing season to date. Luckily Mudgee missed the brunt of it yesterday, so we've still got a lot to come off from Mudgee. But here in Orange, we're about to hit the straps, and thankfully there wasn't a lot of damage out of that rain yesterday.
That's great news. And just for those of us who don't know, can you explain to me what the helicopters are used for?
Oh, yeah, so we get them in. The big thing is to dry the cherries so that the water doesn't sit on top of the cherries, and that's when you get a ring split. So the cherries need to be dried. So wind, you get your tractors out with your spray carts just to blow off the water off the cherries, and then you also get the choppers in that come down really low on the trees, and they just dry them out. So it's expensive, but it's worth it if it saves the crop.
What else has been happening around the region in terms of getting the cherries off the tree? When will that be happening?
Well, everyone's kicking into gear now. We are all a bit short of pickers, so everyone's looking for pickers at the moment. Well, you know, we're sort of probably a few days late where we typically are, but we'll have plenty of cherries going into that Christmas week and good cherries afterwards. But the quality this year has been absolutely excellent, so and the value's good. So I think consumers are going to have a great experience with cherries this year.
Bite Riot owner Fiona Hall ending that report.
The Country Hour.
I found it pretty good, actually.
Yeah, that's it. That's a great question.
You never knock back rain.
The Country Hour.
You know, you should get around it.
Part of your community and your life for 80 years. Yeah!
on ABC Radio.
Well, the high price of electricity in regional areas has come under the spotlight, with local councils set to lobby the New South Wales government for a fairer deal. A motion to local government New South Wales to advocate to the state government for essential energy to align rural supply charges with those in the city and coast recently passed at their annual conference. It follows a push from Narendra Mayor in southwestern New South Wales, Neville Kashinka, for that advocacy. Nicola Sicato reports.
When it comes to paying the electricity bill, regional New South Wales ratepayers are forking out more than double the price of their daily supply charge compared to their metro and coastal counterparts. In metro New South Wales, it can be as low as 79 cents per day, but in regional and rural New South Wales, the lowest supply charge is $1.57. Mayor of Narendra Shire Council Neville Kashinka says it's not good enough.
You know, it's just not fair, and it's been brought to our attention by our own ratepayers and other councils. And we want fair pricing between the two regions. Council passed a motion to send that to LG New South Wales, and that's a whole group of councils in New South Wales, and it got through unanimously that the government lobby essential energy for fairer charges for the rural people.
In New South Wales, electricity retailers set their own prices, but where the network costs are higher, so is the price. The state-owned essential energy network covers regional and rural New South Wales and a few coastal areas. That's 95% of the state's land. It's regulated by the Australian Energy Regulator, meaning predetermined revenue and price controls. In a statement, a spokesperson for the regulator says higher costs on the essential energy network are due to customers using more energy, the fact that it's a larger distribution zone with fewer people, and the cost of poles and wires per customer is higher. Meanwhile, high energy prices are taking a toll on the most vulnerable. Griffiths Linking Communities CEO Kiralee Silvestro says they are always assisting people in applying for the state government's Energy Accounts Payment Assistance Program.
The young person who has to rent a property at perhaps $400 or $500 a week, and then having their electricity on top of that, plus their living allowances, their food, and it just becomes a young person who has to rent a property at perhaps $400 or $500 a week, and then having their electricity on top of that, plus their living allowances, their food, and it just becomes unattainable for people to have rentals by themselves. It's a dire situation, actually, particularly for single parents, young people, those that are struggling to meet the needs of everyday life.
Meanwhile, the federal government has announced they will not extend the electricity bill subsidy into next year.
Nicola Sicato ending that report.
The Country Hour, celebrating 80 years.
We're 3 hours from Catherine, doing School of the Air.
Celebrating 80 years of telling rural stories on ABC Radio.
Well, the first baseline government survey using heat-detecting drones and acoustic recorders has estimated the state's koala population at 274,000. New South Wales Director of Conservation and Restoration Science, Laura Babian, says koalas were found in higher densities and previously spotted in areas like the North Coast, southwest Sydney and on the ranges. Ms Babian says that koalas are threatened by climate change and increased fire risk, also habitat loss and disease, and may still be considered endangered.
We learned that koalas are unevenly distributed in the landscape. So there are places where there are high densities of koalas, and that's particularly in the North Coast, the southwest Sydney area, and then some of the range locations. And then we also found that there are some areas where we didn't know that koalas were even present, but they were able to be detected with the acoustic monitors or with the drones in the evening. And so there were some very pleasant surprises about finding koalas in the landscape where no one even realised that they were there because they're so cryptic. And the other things that were a little bit unexpected with the koala survey was all of the other species that were actually found while the koala surveys were being undertaken, because, of course, when you're flying drones at night, you don't just find koalas, you find gliders and all sorts of other species as well.
So in number terms, what did you learn about koala numbers statewide and of course in the Great Koala National Park planned area?
So we have estimated that there's 274,000 koalas in New South Wales, and we are 95% confident that that range is from 231 to 320,000 koalas. And there was also drone surveys that were undertaken to inform the Great Koala National Park assessment, and that assessment found that there was 12,500 koalas in that assessment area.
How does this compare with the sort of numbers that government was working with to make decisions about koalas up until this survey was done?
The numbers have certainly changed, and that is in response to mostly to changes in technology. So I mentioned the acoustic recorders, but also the drones, which are so good at finding these cryptic species within the landscape. Previously, koalas were found in a range of different ways, and it was time intensive, and also they were still hard to find despite a range of efforts in looking for the koalas. So the technology has made a big difference, and the other piece of information that is new is that, of course, this is a statewide survey that's never been done before. So the baseline helps create a new foundation and reference point for us to make decisions against in the future. But koalas remain threatened. The threats to koalas remain the same, which is that they will be impacted by climate change. They are impacted by habitat fragmentation. They are greatly affected by disease, such as chlamydia. So those things still have to be considered in the management of these iconic species.
Steve Dobbins is a Timber New South Wales forestry scientist, and he says these numbers back up what the industry has long argued, that koalas were in greater numbers and are not in peril.
It reaffirms what we've been saying all along. When the Minns government and Penny came to office, they were stating that there was only 50,000 koalas left in the wild, which we knew to be wrong. That was just based on inverted commas expert opinion, not data. The government's own scientists who've been monitoring koala populations and presence over the last decade, including through the Black Summer fires, have shown that koala populations have been stable throughout that period. And the CSIRO's data, which was released only about a month ago, showed that koalas in Queensland, New South Wales and the ACT really shouldn't be classified as endangered and probably not even vulnerable, because numbers are just under 400,000 through to about 550,000 koalas in the wild throughout that range, which is more than the unlisted population in Victoria, South Australia.
Now, this data that's come out from Penny Sharp's office does include the statement that koalas are still endangered. It also includes the statement that they still face multiple threats in the wild, and there are areas within New South Wales where wild populations have been lost. How accurate is that statement?
There's a bit to break down there. Certainly around New South Wales, there's populations that have been lost. We look at the Pilliga. Pilliga was once known as the koala capital of New South Wales, but the forestry activities in that area ceased, and it was all transferred over to conservation areas under managed fire risk, and as a result, very few koalas left. Forestry activities aren't the threat to koala populations, and the government's own scientists have shown that. They've studied where koalas exist and continue to exist after timber harvesting operations, and compared that to neighbouring national parks, and found koalas in the state forest areas are doing very well. They're actually declined a little bit in the state, in the national parks adjoining them. So major threats of disease, change in fire regimes, particularly wildfire, dog attacks, vehicle strikes, chlamydia in some populations, but certainly forestry activities that are sustainably and well managed and highly regulated as they are in New South Wales are not a threat to koalas.
A New South Wales farmer's Bronwyn Petrie says finally they've got some science now to back up what the farmers have been saying about koala numbers for many years. She told Amelia Bernasconi that she hopes the Premier, Chris Minns, will take heed of the information and focus on koala management on public lands.
That's what we've been saying for a long, long time. And that's what the research by Dr. Brad Law has been showing for many, many years, where he's been doing those acoustic surveys. And that's part of the heartbreak for the people in the timber industry, those rural communities that depend on the industry, and our grazing families who are being evicted from these areas. This is the heartbreak, because this proves exactly what we've been saying, that this this potential extinction has been completely blown out of the water, and the claims prior to the announcement have just been really exacerbated. It just does my head in that people are allowed to claim this false science when we've got real people and we've got real animals at risk here because of the conversion of land we will now see.
Well, I can hear people asking, why didn't the government have this data before it made the announcement around the scale of the Great Koala National Park? I mean, that's probably something we'll put to the politicians later today. But was that curious to you?
I was quite shocked that the announcement seemed to be preemptive. It seemed to be a rushed announcement. Anyone who thought there was not going to be an announcement of a Great Koala National Park were also in fairyland. Of course, the government was going to announce a park. It's the extent of the announcement that the entire 176,000 hectares was included in one fell swoop. And I would like to know who has briefed the Premier. It came out weeks before the government's own report by the NRC, the Natural Resource Commission. That report also showed that koala populations were stable within state forests. It came out before the CSIRO report, which came out at the same time, only a few matter of weeks after the announcement. This survey forms part of that. The other thing that astonished me was that the Premier and the Minister for Environment, Penny Sharp, on that same day, on Father's Day, said, this will now protect the old growth forests. You have not been allowed to harvest any old growth trees since 1995, so 30 years. So who is providing this false information to our Premier, who I believe is really genuine in trying to do what he needs to do? But this has completely distorted the real facts, and we're pleased that at least some honesty is coming out.
Well, we've been hearing that the koala could be extinct by 2050, and, you know, like you say, you can understand why the protections are coming into play. But having this data, do you think it will help the state's farmers now that, and we haven't seen any maps as to where the numbers, the bigger populations are from this survey, but yeah, how do you think having this data, what will it mean, I guess, the broader picture beyond the Great Koala National Park as well, to certain impacts on how people can farm in New South Wales?
Well, I hope it impacts on how our public lands are managed in New South Wales, because koalas can't fly away in a fire. Where you've got koalas, where you've got these precious animals, you should have a maximum fuel load underneath so you do not get the crown fires. Hearing stories about how in those fires of 2019, 2020, fires racing out of the national heating land or perpetual lease areas within state forest that the graziers had done their cool burns on, and those fires dropping out of the trees and being able to be managed, saving villages, saving communities. We have restrictions on private land about koala habitat. I would hope that some restrictions are now placed on public land management to ensure protecting these lovely koalas and the other things that are in there.
Bronwyn Petrie is with New South Wales Farmers, also a farmer of many years and interested in the issue of koalas and forestry. She was talking there to Amelia Bernasconi. It's coming up to 29 minutes past 12. We were talking about the prawn industry in New South Wales yesterday. The seafood industry experts, they're going to say now that it's a backward step for biosecurity if the federal government adopts a proposal to move disease testing of raw imported prawns offshore. Biosecurity was beefed up after a 2017 Senate inquiry examined a number of failures, which included allowing white spot disease into Australian waters in uncooked imported prawns. They say that there's a double standard now with prawns from infected areas of southeast Queensland and northern New South Wales, as we heard yesterday, are now required to be cooked, while raw prawns continue to be imported from countries struggling to contain that disease. Jennifer Nichols has more.
Currently, samples are taken and tested from 100% of the containers of uncooked imported prawns on arrival in Australia. But last month, the Federal Department of Agriculture announced proposed changes. It released guidelines for the evaluation of overseas pre-export testing of raw prawns headed to Australia. If approved, it would move testing offshore before export, overseen by what the department describes as competent authorities.
The industry is right to be concerned because it's a definite backward step, probably back to the bad old days when we had inadequate controls that allowed white spot into the country.
Dr. Ben Diggles is an aquatic animal health specialist, a disease expert who travels the world providing biosecurity risk assessments to industry and governments. And he's scathing of the proposed testing changes for raw imported prawns.
Well, this one's crazy because they're devolving responsibility. Because of inadequate funding, they're devolving responsibility for our border controls to countries which have already shown that they can't keep these diseases out. So I think they've painted themselves into a corner with an unnecessarily complicated and unreliable testing regime when they should take note from countries such as New Caledonia, which avoid all these problems by simply requiring all their imported prawns to be cooked.
White spot disease has devastated prawn farming on Queensland's Logan River and New South Wales' Clarence River since Australia's first outbreak in 2016. Farmers and wild caught fishers south of Caloundra and in northern New South Wales cannot move prawns out of their regions without first cooking them.
This comes back to the fact that they're enforcing like a higher level of protection for prawns travelling from Queensland to Western Australia out of, say, the white spot zone than they are importing them from other countries which have a range of other diseases they're not testing for.
Queensland Seafood Industry Association Executive Officer David Bobberman and Jennifer Nichols with that report. We've actually requested some information from the Primary Industries Minister, Julie Collins, about that move in terms of biosecurity and raw prawns. So we're hoping to see a statement maybe or an interview with the Minister about some of those changes that people are calling for next week on the program. It's coming up to 28 minutes to one. It's time to get some news headlines. Adam Storey's there. Good afternoon.
Afternoon, Michael. The Prime Minister has just spoken in Newcastle. There has been a deal to keep the Tomago aluminium smelter open beyond 2028. The company and the Commonwealth have agreed to there's an agreement for there to be an agreement, but details to be finalised in the new year. He may have given some more detail in that press conference he's just given, but unfortunately I wasn't able to keep across it.
Right.
So I was standing here with bated breath waiting to talk to you.
You can't do everything.
The words that come up on the TV.
Oh, right.
Captions? Captions, thank you.
Subtitles?
The subtitles weren't quite making sense.
Yeah, they're quite weird sometimes.
I thought I'll keep away from it. Yeah, something. So they started talking about a sandwich there at one stage, so I think that's not quite right. Anyway, details to come on that one. Meanwhile, the Transport for New South Wales says it's confident the state can still reach its target of halving the number of road deaths by 2030. That's despite an increase in fatalities in 2025. So in the year to date, 333 people have died in road crashes across the state, and that's up 8% from 2024. The government is now facing a second High Court challenge to its teen social media ban. The platform Reddit is filing an application with the High Court today. It's speaking special leave to argue the new law is invalid under the Constitution. because it interferes with the implied freedom of political communication, which is the same case that has been launched by another group that is challenging the laws. A sentencing date has been set for the man who pleaded guilty to murdering his former partner, Molly Ticehurst. Daniel Billings has faced a brief arraignment hearing in the Supreme Court. He appeared via video link. He is awaiting sentencing for the killing of 28-year-old Molly Ticehurst in her home at Forbes in the state's central west. He pleaded guilty to murder in the Forbes local court last month. State and Territory Health Ministers are meeting in Canberra, pushing for a better deal on hospital funding. The Prime Minister yesterday offered an extra $1 billion on top of the $20 billion that was on offer over a five-year period, but some states have already said that offer is still not enough. And the Time Person of the Year is... Architects of AI for 2025. The magazine says it was the year when the potential of artificial intelligence has, in quote, roared into view with no turning back for humanity. Ain't that the truth?
That's right.
Leave you with that happy Friday thought, and I'll see you Monday.
So the Time Person of the Year is Hal from...
Hal, yeah.
From Space Odyssey 2000.
Wow. Hello, Michael.
Oh, yeah, you've done that before.
How are you?
Well,
you'll be talking to Hal before you know it.
Well, that's right. But you won't be. Hal won't be reading the news, though, hopefully.
No.
Thanks for that, Adam.
I wouldn't mind if he did.
Thank you, Adam.
All right.
We'll talk to you later. And Adam will be back at 1 o'clock. It's time to find out what's happening with the weather details. And Ed Medlock's there. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Michael.
So, yeah, there's been a bit of more rain than maybe some of the forecasts were. There'd be more rain in certain areas that didn't sort of pan out. What sort of rain, how much rain are we seeing and where?
Yeah, some places overperformed yesterday, some underperformed. Pretty broadly, we saw some 10 to 40 millimetre totals across the northwest. Slopes and plains, some in the central west as well. I've got a few rainfall totals in front of me. We had some of the highs of Walkden, got 71.5 millimetres yesterday. Mount Lindsay and Kira got around 65. Angledore got 59 millimetres, and Kewdall got 50.2 millimetres yesterday. So some places had some higher totals above 50 where there was those thunderstorms, but we didn't see any places get above 100, for example.
Right, okay. It's a big... A big difference in area between Angledore and Kewdall.
Yes, so, they're not close to each other.
No, not at all. But, I mean, so it was patchy. It was here and there.
Yes, patchy here and there, all pretty much thunderstorm-driven and showers. And, yeah, the places that got the high totals were just pretty much where the thunderstorms formed and then stuck around for an hour or two. A lot of these totals built up over an hour or even half an hour. From thunderstorms just not moving on from where they formed, and that's just owing to the very poor steering that we had in the atmosphere yesterday.
Right, so they just put a dump of rain down and moved along really pretty quickly.
No, well, almost the opposite. Kind of they formed over a rain gauge or a little town and then kind of sat there for an hour and didn't go away.
Right.
They brought up the totals, but it just means that the places where they didn't form got, you know, very little, if not none.
Mm. And what are we going to see for the next 24 hours?
So we've got some ongoing shower activity pretty broadly across the east, mostly in the central east and the northeast today. That's going along, but as things heat up this afternoon, we should expect a return to some storm activity along the ranges, slopes and inland plains, possibly severe, with less of a heavy rainfall risk today inland, more of a damaging wind and large hail risk. But as the storms in the northeast, which are currently showers, do turn into storms this afternoon, they might bring some additional heavy rainfall to areas of the mid-north coast, northern tablelands and northern rivers.
Any threat of any flooding at all?
Not on the cards at the moment, at least according to the initial modelling. But once the rain actually does fall out of the ground into the rivers and we get some measurements in our gauges, we'll be able to tell what those downstream flows are going to look like.
Yeah, there was some talk about the mid-north coast as well, but it doesn't look as likely now by the sound of things. And also areas like Western Sydney too, but that seems less likely now.
Yeah, it does, and it's tough when things are not so much the widespread rain, more just kind of that thunderstorm and shower-driven hit-and-miss rainfall.
Mm. And moving further ahead into the, you know, over the weekend and Monday, what are we seeing? Still showers?
still some showers and thunderstorms. The systems that are driving today's weather kind of move off into Queensland and offshore this afternoon, but tomorrow through Saturday, particularly during the early morning through to the afternoon period, there is a cold front that's going to be making its way across the state during Saturday, and then another one on Sunday. But so through Saturday across the inland, we've got some additional risk of thunderstorms pretty scattered across the inland, including, you know, pretty much everywhere, including the Riverina, central west, northern inland. Still a risk of some severe storms as well in those storms as the cold front makes its way through, but not so much along the ranges and in eastern areas. So kind of a severe storm risk just for the west on Saturday.
So a bit of rainfall possible, central west, Riverina, but it's not certain, and we don't know how much.
Yeah, it's again thunderstorm-driven activity, not widespread rain. Depends where the storms form, for sure.
Okay. All right, Ed, thanks for that.
Thank you, Michael.
20 minutes to one here on the Country Hour. Well, talking about the weather, the Bureau of Meteorology has unveiled further changes to its controversial new website. It says it's had 70 million website visits and 400,000 items of community feedback on that website that cost nearly $100 million to build and has, of course, been widely criticised since its launch. She didn't want to talk about the cost of the website, but senior meteorologist at the Bureau, Andrea Peace, talked to Warwick Long about some of the changes that have happened already.
We have made some changes, as you said, just this week. We've made some changes to the weather map, the radar page, also some other information around forecast or observed temperatures. Just generally tried to make a few changes that we've had some feedback on from the community make some performance improvements and some new features for the community.
Yeah, when you say feedback, a lot of feedback by the looks of it. 400,000 items, is that right?
Well, the last I heard was around 300, but could very well be around 400,000. And, you know, that's fantastic. That is the community speaking and really helping shape the website that they, you know, that they use all the time. And it's helping us prioritise what it is we do next with the websites. A lot of people put in feedback that they were having some trouble with the little indicator where they were on the radar. So now when you log on to the weather map page, which has the radar in it, it was, I think, a black colour. Now it's a nice red colour, so you can really see very clearly where you are. And another thing that we've done is really tried to make the radar and weather page a bit easier to customise. So now when you click on the information around the layers, what you actually want to display on the weather page, you can actually, on the left-hand side now, we've got all of the weather-related information and then the map settings, which used to be on the left-hand side and now on the right-hand side. People were telling us that they weren't really using those so much. What they wanted right where they are sort of looking on the left-hand side is all their weather information. So they wanted to be able to click the rain, they wanted to be able to click wind, they wanted to be able to click the forecast. And that's where you can also select whether you look at the radar and reflectivity or rain rate. We've just really been listening to the community and making those changes to hopefully make it just a little bit easier for them to navigate the new site.
So are more changes on the way?
Absolutely. So the themes that are coming through really strongly are helping us prioritise what we do next. One of the big things that we did do this time around was because we know everyone loves the radar and some people were having a little bit of challenge kind of finding it if you hadn't put in a particular location. So we now have a button right on the very front page that you can just click on just right under Discover Your Weather, which you can't miss. And so you can just now click directly from there to the rain and radar without having to put in a location. So that will help, hopefully help people navigate to there. So you can pop in your location once you get to there and then that'll zoom in on where you are. So continual improvement we'll keep everyone updated as new changes do occur.
Senior meteorologist Andrea Peace from the Bureau of Meteorology speaking there with Warwick Long.
80 years of the Country Hour.
You'd get in trouble for talking at church on a Sunday, but you'd get in more trouble if you were talking during the weather, during the Country Hour, any day of the week. That was always a good childhood memory of ours, and we've learned very quickly that this is an incredibly important part of the day, around that 12:30 every day, and you don't talk when the weather is on.
The Country Hour,
celebrating 80 years of telling rural stories.
Well, virtual fencing is now legal in New South Wales, with just Victoria and South Australia left waiting for legislation. The technology is described as a game changer, especially for dairy farmers and those moving to regenerative agriculture systems. But not everyone is convinced. It involves putting a collar on livestock that sends out noises and an electric pulse to the animal if they approach a virtual fence line, as Emily Middleton reports.
Virtual fencing has been officially legalised in New South Wales, and users of the technology in other states are already labelling it as a lifesaver. Farmers are spending significantly less time and money checking and moving stock, and with that comes huge lifestyle benefits, spending more time at home with family and a slashed petrol bill. But with the electronics reliant on telecommunication towers and satellites, some farmers have questioned their trustworthiness during emergencies.
I think it'll be a pretty handy tool. I see the advantage of the virtual fencing as, I guess, replacing a hot wire where you might normally run an electric fence to subdivide a paddock.
Angus McIntosh is a mixed farmer based in Molong in central west New South Wales. He's got roughly 2,000 sheep and 100 cows on his 1,400 hectare property. Angus is interested in taking up virtual fencing on his small scale property, but he's got a few concerns.
Yeah, I guess just the maintenance of the collars, or the technology, I should say, and how reliable they are, I suppose, in keeping charged, and how effective they are, whether any animals, you know, can get past, I guess, which is very similar to a hot wire. Obviously, the cost is the main concern, and there's a little bit of labour involved in initially getting a mob set up with it, and obviously getting set up with the software, so. Yeah, they're the real concerns, just nutting out reliability of the technology, yeah, once it rolls out.
Brent Thomas is the Director of Strategic Relations at Holter, one of the manufacturers of virtual fencing apps and collars. He said when it comes to holding up in emergencies like bushfires and flooding, farmers in other states have already put the technology to the test.
What we've seen in cases of natural disasters is that Holter plays an incredibly important role. For example, we had some severe storms in Tasmania last year, and farmers were able to move their animals remotely away from dangerous power lines without sending out staff and putting them in danger in the middle of the night, just by using the app. And in the same way, if there's a bushfire coming, there's an opportunity for farmers to move their cattle to safer places. We always do encourage farmers to leave the perimeter fence up, and often the law requires that to be the case as well. So there is still that ultimate perimeter fence around the whole property. But there's a number of different safeguards built into the property, into the product as well, in case there are emergency situations. But what we hear from farmers is that the technology allows them to keep their animals safer in times of natural disasters, and also to keep their staff safer by not sending them into harm's way.
But, as Mr. Thomas explained, the technology is still reliant on telecommunication towers.
We install our own towers on farmers' property as well to ensure that there's additional connectivity for farmers wherever they might be. There's really three parts when a farmer, and there's lots of them in New South Wales, are excited about this, want to install Holter on their property. There's three things. There's the collars that everybody talks about. There's the app that a farmer will see on their phone or their laptop, but there's also towers, connectivity towers, and we, Holter works with farmers to install some additional towers on their property as they're needed, so that the collars and the app can always talk to a farmer.
Robert McIntosh is the chair of the Animal Welfare Committee for the New South Wales Farmers Association.
Effectively, there is some restriction if it's all to do with telecommunication communications.
He said to the advantage of virtual fencing, this kind of technology will be able to aid farmers in times of distress.
The reality is there's a lot of satellite navigation goes on with it as well, and that's a lot more consistent and more reliable for farmers. So I think that's we're seeing a lot more of the technology using satellite and more of that sort of tracking rather than just telecommunications. We do get flash floodings and flooding events, and being able to move cattle quickly into a safe environment or move them right off the flat quickly is a very good feature of the whole system.
While the price is dependent on farmer to farmer, according to the Holter website, costs can start from $9.90 per cow per month. For 100 cows, this is $11,880 per year. Another manufacturer, Gallagher's product E Shepherd, encourages farmers to buy the collars outright, which are roughly $350 per cow, as well as pay a $2 to $2.50 a month fee per head to access the app. E Shepherd also have a one-off tower fee, which is around $6,000 per tower. For now, farmers across the state have already begun gearing up to be some of the first to use their technology in New South Wales.
That's reporter Emily Middleton with that report there. It's it's not time to go to markets. It's coming up to 10 minutes to one.
You're listening to The Country Hour
on ABC Radio New South Wales.
Hello, I'm Andy Park. Join me for The World Today. The nation's health ministers meet to tackle so-called bed block, with more than 3,000 aged care patients stranded in public hospitals, according to new figures. We're now losing more tax revenue on black market illegal tobacco than we're collecting on legal tobacco, forcing a rethink on attempts at a crackdown. And meet the new breed of birdfluencers, young birdwatchers sharing their finds with a huge social media following. Join me for those stories on The World Today.
To snakes now, and 10-year-old Johanna Lamb was taking a break from her schoolwork and stepping into her cubby house when a deadly brown snake struck out from beneath the floorboards, biting her big left toe. She survived thanks to her family's fast response and a helicopter rescue, and is now giving back to her community, raising thousands of dollars by selling two of their prized stud cattle. Claudia Sullivan has more.
Johanna Lamb is an optimistic kid, and like the rest of her family of beef producers, loves being outdoors. But even this tough 10-year-old Queenslander admits she was a bit stressed after being bitten by a brown snake in September. And it wasn't the more common dry bite. She was injected with a snake's deadly venom.
When I got bitten by a snake, I ran up to the school room, and Mum wasn't even out the door by the time I'd got there. And she took me inside and saw the snake bite, so she put a belt just under my knee and then wrapped it with bandages. Dad was down at the yards just about to get him off a cattle in, so he come up and drove us to the hospital. And then I got flown out by a helicopter, which was fun.
It was fun, was it?
Sort of.
What was everyone like who was helping you as well?
They were really nice, and they were checking my eyes with flashlights just to see if the reaction, and they were checking my heartbeat to check if it was good. And every 5 to 10 minutes in the ICU hospital in Rockhampton, they would take some of my blood. When I was in emergency, I had one nurse, and she said, "It'll be fine. I've been here for 20 years, and I've seen so many snake bites, and only two have been envenomated, and they've both been snake catchers." And then the bloods come in, and it went from one nurse to five nurses and two doctors very quickly.
Wow. So what was it like then when everyone came into the room?
It was a little bit stressful. My toe was hurting like a lot because of all the blood circulation getting cut off, so they had to put me in happy gas. I got my bed up to the emergency room, and I think it was 3 days that I had to be in there, but for the first 36 hours I couldn't get out of bed because my blood was so thin that if I got up, I could hemorrhage inside and they wouldn't be able to stop it.
Wow, that's very intense. Were you scared?
No, I was, like, I looked okay on the outside, but in the inside I was like, I really want to get out of bed.
Was it hard staying in bed for 3 days?
Yes.
Johanna is now in good spirits, but her father, Daniel Lamb, says the day is etched in his memory.
Just all those things run through your head.
You know, you don't want to think about a 10-year-old kid having to plan. But anyway, we just did the best we could and got to Rocky in time to get the anti-venom in time, and it all worked out. But, yeah, those first half an hour, really, or hour, was, a little bit traumatising.
The Lambs have organised the sale of two of their prized stud cows to raise money for Johanna's helicopter rescuers, as well as the local Theodore-based Brangus Youth Camp.
I've got a heifer and a steer that I have. My brothers are helping me break in, and we're taking them to the Brangus Youth Camp to sell and donate that money to the helicopter people, mainly because they saved my life.
How much effort has gone into breaking them?
Lots. We get a stick and we have a little broken pillowcase on the end, so we flag them. We hose them off and blow them with our blower. We dance around like lunatics. We play really, really loud music just to get them calm to loud noises. I'm hoping to raise with the steer and the heifer up to $8,000 to $10,000 on each.
CAP Rescue's Rockhampton-based clinical lead, Dr. Tim Smith, said it was important to be cautious as snakes are more active at this time of year.
With good first aid, with early recognition and call for help, and early anti-venom and critical care management, the prognosis can be good with full recovery. The problems you can get from a snake bite can include, unfortunately, bleeding to death. The other things it can do is cause issues with your nervous system, and you actually can become paralysed, and that can affect your breathing.
Dr. Smith also said anyone who is bitten by a snake should assume it is venomous.
When you are bitten by one, you need to move away from the snake, and then you need to call for help and lay down. If you try and run for help or move away, you actually pump venom around your body.
Claudia Sullivan bringing that report to us. Let's go to markets now. Scary stuff, that. Don't like snakes. Let's go to Griffith Sheep and Lambs.
Good afternoon. The last sale of the year for Griffith offered 7,800 lambs. The quality was mixed with some very light Dorper selling to restockers, good numbers of trade lambs and a few crossbred lambs, mainly trade and heavyweights. Merinos still were very limited. The market was very strong on the right light restocking lambs. Lambs 16 to 20 kilos were dearer by $6 to $7. Trades were firm and heavyweights firm to $6 dearer. Restocking lambs under 12 kilos dressed were out to $142. Trade lambs $220 to $255, averaging $10.40 to $10.60. Heavyweights $260 to $280. The Shawn crossbred trades $218 to $265. Heavyweights $255 to $283. And extra heavies topped at $330. Most of the Shawn lambs $10.60 to $1,100. Mutton numbers eased to 5,300. Prices are around $20 cheaper. The medium weight ewes 156 to 176. Heavy crossbreds reach 280. Merinos 244. And most range from 680 to 750. The first sale in the new year is on January the 9th.
Let's go to Tamworth cattle now.
Tamworth pen 3102, good quality cattle including 400 calves and calves, for the majority of young cattle available. This is the final straw sale for 2025. Steer wean is dear for the most part, but yearling steers cheaper. Vendors from various areas to include Scone, Niangla, Barabra, Gloucester, Moree, Walcott and Castlers. Buyers included feed lovers and backgrounders. Angus steers under 200 kilos, 960 to 1260. Bosinigus Cross 81 better, 800 to 1220. Barrelay steers 730 to 1150. Crossbred steers to 280 kilos much dearer, 1260 to 1350. Similar Angus steers to $100 better, 1110 to 1690. Angus steers to 330 kilos, 54 dearer, 1380 to 1680. Heavy Angus wean is $12 dearer, 1590 to 1820. Angus yearlings 1270 to 1400. Bosinigus steers 1100 to 1410, and heavy Angus yearlings 1650 to 1840. Presently raining, heifers and cows still to be sold. Stephen Evans, MLA at Tamworth.
It's coming up to 1 minute to one.
Coming up on Country Breakfast on Radio National tomorrow, how to protect freshwater turtles' eggs from hungry foxes, and the 10-year-old girl who survived a snake bite.
She took me inside and saw the snake bite, so she put her belt just under my knee. Dad was down at the yards just about to get him of a cattle in.
we'll hear about the chopper flight that saved her life. Join me, David Claughton, at 6 o'clock Saturday mornings or any time on the ABC Listen app for Country Breakfast.
You've been listening to the New South Wales Country Hour. Have a fabulous weekend. If you want some rain, I hope you get it. We're heading up to news time.